The people we vote for can have a profound effect on our lives. Thomas Frank wrote a book several years ago called What's the Matter with Kansas? It was not the first time someone pointed out that people will vote for the people in positions they like, even if that's a vote against their own economic interest. Our guest this hour focuses on Kansas and two other states to point out it goes beyond economic interest all the way to lifespan. Jonathan Metzl demonstrates how public policy can reduce life expectancy in his book Dying of Whiteness, how the politics of racial resentment is killing America's heartland. This is a realm of study that Jonathan Metzl is familiar with. He's an MD and an expert on gun violence and mental illness. He directs the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University and is a professor of sociology and psychiatry there. Jonathan Metzl, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So certainly some of this has been said before. People who vote for conservative policies are often hurt by them. I mean, why can't opposing politicians effectively make that case?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that was kind of the core premise of the book is looking at the material, what happens to the material realities of people's lives as a result of the policies that their politicians put into action. What I did over the course of the book is I basically asked the question, what happens if you live in a city or state where your politicians have done things like block the Affordable Care Act and the resultant Medicaid expansion, or allow the free flow of guns without any kind of plan for public safety, or enact major tax cuts that end up cutting funding for roads, bridges, and schools, and particularly in white working class communities. And what I found was that those policies themselves, as you suggested in your introduction, ended up serving almost like risk factors, like asbestos or secondhand smoke or not wearing seatbelts in your cars. And so the first part of the book, what I do is I track really what are the health implications and show that actually, as you say, people's lifespans are being actually shortened by these policies. And then the next part of the book, I ask that complicated question of what would it take to change somebody's mind, and is it a question of presenting a better policy, or is it a question of addressing the underlying assumptions about race and whiteness that go into these policies?
Well, and you write in the introduction that you're convinced reasonable people might find middle ground if left to their own devices. So who or what will not leave them to their own devices?
Well, part of what I appreciated, I should say, you know, I spent about 8 years researching this book, and I spent time in Missouri talking to people in very, very pro-gun areas, very pro-gun towns. I did a bunch of focus groups and met with people. I talked to people across Tennessee who were themselves medically ill, but they were supporting their politicians who were blocking Medicaid expansion that would have benefited them, groups like that. So I talked to people, and what I often found was that these were probably people I would have been fighting with on Twitter if we just had social media, you know, I'm pro this, I'm anti that. But in reality, when I ended up talking to people, it turned out that people even in the most extreme political positions were willing to kind of work with me to find some kind of, like, I would ask them, what do you think is a way forward? And I found that, you know, much to my surprise, we could often find some points of common ground. But unfortunately, even if interpersonally we could find common ground, those weren't the positions that the politicians that they voted for ended up supporting.
So, and there's another example in here that just sort of stands out. You come back to a couple times in the book of the man you call Trevor. You explain that's not his real name, but he lives in Tennessee where there was no Medicaid expansion, says he would rather die than have Tennessee adopt Obamacare and the Medicaid expansion.
That's why I named the book The Dying of Whiteness. Colleagues of mine and I were doing focus groups in Tennessee around the time that the Affordable Care Act was being debated in states like Tennessee, states that really needed health care. And we would meet groups of white and black men and talk to them about just what's the promise of what would it mean to adopt the, you know, to get more health care in this state. And we found a number of men who were like this man, Trevor. Trevor was a man who was probably in his mid-40s and had a very chronic set of medical conditions. He had liver failure. He was having a hard time breathing. He actually came to the group we did pulling an oxygen tank because he couldn't really breathe on his own completely. So this was somebody who was literally on death's doorstep and really needed medical help. And when we had this group, and I said, basically, here's this program. We're in Nashville, so a half an hour away in Kentucky, people were actually adopting the Medicaid expansion. So I said, a half an hour away, if you lived in Kentucky, you could be benefiting from everything that the Affordable Care Act brings. You know, help with your prescriptions, help with routine office visits. And what he told me was, you know, I know that it could probably help somebody like me, and certainly I need the help. But to be honest, there's no way I want my tax dollars paying for Mexicans or welfare queens. That was the quote that I heard from him and from other people who were willing to kind of share those sentiments with me. Obviously, those are incredibly problematic racist assumptions. But if you just think about it, think about how powerful that ideology is, that here's somebody who's basically saying, I have an identity as a Republican, as a my conceptualization of a white American, and I'm literally willing to lay down on the tracks so that other people, other you know, minorities and immigrants don't get the benefits that are due to me or people in my group.
So I don't get it, but at least they don't get it. So is Trevor an outlier, do you think, Jonathan, or is he right in the middle of the pack of the people you talk to?
Well, I talk to a lot of people in this book, and I would say that a good majority, and I make this clear in the book, we're not just saying things that were overtly racist or based in overt racial assumptions. What I argue in the book was that I'm not trying to get into anybody's mind, so I don't know who I talked to was racist, and it wasn't my goal to kind of understand what's in somebody's heart. What I did come to realize is that these policies, these politics of kind of this message, this anti-government, staunchly pro-gun, kind of tax-cutting, infrastructure, things like that, these messages, the two things I show, one was that the policies themselves, the messages, were completely racially laden. There were long racial histories that explained why those politics were successful in working-class white populations. And ultimately, what I show is that somebody's individual assessment didn't really matter. What matters is that you lived in a state that enacted those policies. That was the risk to your health.
All right, so we'll talk more about Missouri with guns, Tennessee with no Medicaid expansion, and Kansas with big tax and service cuts as we continue into Jonathan Metzl's book, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange. We invite you to join us by phone and email when we return in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Jonathan Metzl, who's an MD, psychiatrist, sociologist based at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, lives in Tennessee, has lived in Missouri and Kansas, focuses on all three states, for a book he calls Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. He looks at Missouri's gun laws, Tennessee's lack of Medicaid expansion, and Kansas and its big tax and service cuts, to talk about how people get their life expectancies reduced by the policies enacted by the people they vote for. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jonathan, a question that, just in general that I will probably ask now and at the end of the program, which is the response from these people, I'm certain, would be in some cases, so what? This is the stuff I believe in. These are the people I believe in. And it occurred to me last night driving home, this is sort of like the people who say, yeah, I know cheeseburgers can shorten my life, but I'll still eat them.
Right. We all do things that are, I mean, health is just one way that we make decisions about who we vote for or what we do. I ride my bike, and I don't always wear a bike helmet. You know, there are certainly many instances of Democratic politics and successful Democratic politicians who have enacted policies that are bad for the populations that they claim to represent. So, in a certain way, I would say that that's exactly true. And part of the story I tell in this book is not so much about some kind of gotcha politics where I was trying to say, look at these people and what they're doing. It's actually to educate liberal voters to say, look at the extent to which conservative voters, many of whom are, you know, I have many friends and people in my own family, and I live in Tennessee, I'm from Kansas City, and to say, look, you're underestimating the extent to which people support these ideological positions. I think when the election happened in 2016, there was this kind of liberal fantasy that people were just going to wake up when they saw that Trump's policies were bad for them. And that wasn't the case, you know, that there were bigger factors at play. So part of my aim in this book is actually to educate people about the depth to which people support these ideological positions. And at the same time, as you were saying in your lead-in just now, the costs of that ideological support are huge. I mean, when I studied the gun laws in Kansas, for example, I showed that basically just in the 3 years after a particular bill passed that made it much easier for people to get guns in Kansas, it ended up costing the state about $300 million and over 11,000 solid life years of people. In Tennessee, I found that not expanding Medicaid cost every citizen of the state about 3 weeks of life expectancy. And so, you know, I guess the question here is, yes, people support their ideologies, but what trade-offs are they willing to make, and how can we accept that as a society?
Well, let's come back to that term you just used, because just in case people thought you were talking astronomy, you did not say light years, you said life years. What does that mean?
Life years. Basically, there's a lot of the book's divided into kind of three states, but those states are divided into three sections because this is obviously a very complicated story and one that has many factors. So the core of each section talks about just me talking to people and focus groups and interviews and structured and unstructured interviews just to get a sense of what on the ground people are saying. I then go back in history and I tell the history of why guns and education and healthcare systems themselves have racial histories that we should think about as Americans because they weren't just invented yesterday, and that's important for people to know about. And then the third part is I jump into data, take some deep dives into big data sets, and in a hopefully user-friendly way, in a way that you don't need to be a social science expert to understand, I show that basically there are indicators that you can track before and after effects for what it means when these... So basically, I can show at a kind of microscopic level what happens before and after policies, particular policies, are enacted, and what happens to longevity. And one way that longevity is tracked in a lot of data sets is called quality of life years. That's a kind of public health measure. So one indicator I used was just how many quality, in other words, how many years off of people's lives were taken by the fact that they didn't have health care in Tennessee. And then I just added it all up, and that's where I got these, I think, pretty startling numbers.
So we've talked, I know, for folks in our part of the country about California, for example, where the rural life expectancy is definitely dropping from things like rural suicides. I mean, are we talking about a clear drop in life expectancy in all three of these states?
It's actually astounding, but yes, that's true. And the other remarkable part about this is that the life expectancy that's dropping in all three states is dropping in the dominant group, right? So actually white male life expectancy is what's falling in a lot of these states. That's pretty much unheard of in the history of Western civilization for a number of reasons. Usually the kind of life expectancy falls we're seeing result from a famine or a huge political upheaval or a war, a bomb, something like that. And so the fact that we're in a time of relative prosperity and working class life expectancies are falling, it has to do with many things, obviously addiction, opiates, factors like that, poverty, but also about infrastructure. And what the story I tell is, here's what happens when you cut away infrastructure and give people a lot of guns. What happens is life expectancy falls.
Jonathan Metzl, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. And again, it's Missouri, Tennessee, and Kansas. Let's go to Missouri first. I went to the University of Missouri, and I just don't recognize what happens in the state now, because you can get a skewed view, granted, living in a university town like Columbia, but I don't recognize Missouri. And so they changed the state constitution and state law and ended up with what kinds of attitudes on guns?
Well, I'm from Kansas City also. I went to the University of Missouri, Kansas City, so I'm a Mizzou alum also. And for me, you know, my parents still live in Kansas City. I went to high school there. I went to college there. And then I left. But the Missouri that I grew up in, the Kansas City that I grew up in, was one in which people had dramatically different ideological positions. They disagreed about red or blue, pro or anti-gun, pro or anti-abortion, other kinds of factors, but somehow in the Kansas City that I'm from, we found a way to make it work. There were often power-sharing agreements in the state Senate where people would alternate power between Republicans and Democrats, and just on a day-to-day level, there was a kind of can-do attitude that we were kind of all working for the betterment of the state. And what happened really starting in about 2007, 2008 is that Kansas and Missouri kind of went out the window with the advent of groups like the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus and the advent of laws that made it much easier for people to get guns. And what I found in the book is that when this starts happening, particularly with these gun laws, that people start to become far more mistrustful of each other because they're worried about if somebody else might be armed. And so the key story I tell is that in 2007 and 2008, there were laws that were passed in Missouri that upended a long-held practice of how people got permits to get guns. They used to have to actually apply at the sheriff's office to get a gun permit. And what happens in 2007, 2008 is that all those laws start to get pitched out the window, and Missouri becomes, in a way, a state where open carry and concealed carry are incredibly easy. It's very easy to buy a gun, to carry a gun, to purchase a gun. Now, many people said, this is great. This is great for the Second Amendment. We have a much more armed society. People can carry guns. But what I show is it doesn't just lead to increased rates of injury and death. That definitely happens. And increased rates of suicide. It's also that people become wary. They become much more mistrustful of each other in some pretty pronounced ways.
So then when we talk about Missouri's gun laws, I mean, so what are you seeing is the primary change in health stats there?
Well, what I see in Missouri is basically that there were three key points. In 2007, 2008, they upend what's called the permit to purchase law. You didn't really need to go and get, there was no real process to get a permit. And then there were two bills passed in 2012, 2014 that were what were called guns everywhere bills. Basically, this assumption that you could open carry, and if you didn't have a permit with you, you could carry in public. And I just tracked the data. Now, according to a lot of the kind of NRA rhetoric, it was, you know, people need to be armed to worry about gangs and carjackers and factors like that. But the numbers that I crunched across the state showed that the biggest rise in injury and death, really death statistics, were because white male suicide started to go through the roof, that in a way, men living in rural communities who had access to guns, those were the people who were dying of gun death because it was much easier for them to get guns, and what we saw was dramatic rises in white male suicide.
Jonathan Metzl, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an MD, psychiatrist, professor of sociology at Vanderbilt University, the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, looked at Missouri, Tennessee, and Kansas for his book, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. A lot to talk about here. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we talked about how whites are very much overrepresented, it seems, in the numbers of suicides caused by guns in Missouri since the liberalization of gun laws there, if you can call it liberalization. So if anyone can openly carry a gun, how is that working out for people of color?
Well, you know, I invite people to look at the interviews I did across Missouri, and I kind of reproduce them verbatim just to show how conflicted people are. I'll never forget, I was actually in Columbia and in Kansas City talking to people in the African-American communities, and I said, hey, look, you know, it's much easier for people to get and carry guns. How do you guys feel about that? And many of my respondents basically said, we're terrified of this. One man named John, who I spoke with, he and his family used to shop at Sam's Club. That was their favorite place to go and pick up stuff for their house. And what they told me was, you know, we now see these white guys walking down the aisles in Sam's Club with their guns in their holsters, and they saw it as a form of racial intimidation, and so they ended up not shopping there and going other places. I talked to a pastor of an African-American church in St. Louis who basically said that having all of these guns around, they also seemed very racially charged, and it reminded people in her congregation of the threat not only to violence but also of police violence. And so people in the African-American community were across the board pretty much not supportive of the liberalization of these gun laws because it turned out they weren't the people who were being allowed to open carry and walk into Walmart or Starbucks.
So we had mentioned earlier that you, it was not your job to get into people's heads and try to figure out if they're racist or not. You say you don't want to minimize the larger effects. Whiteness in the context of the title of the book often seems to come up as something that's less about skin color than what?
Public policy. I mean, I'm a white American and I'm not comfortable telling a story of like us and them, right? I try to be very clear that there are systems around whiteness more broadly that it's not like, you know, that basically privilege works in many ways in this country. And so it's not like I was going down. I mean, I was going home in a way to talk to people here. But I think that the lesson I was trying to say was, I'm not talking about whiteness as a biology, probably even as a skin color. What I was trying to say is that there's a particular strain of American backlash politics that's very driven by this white racial resentment. And when that strain starts to work its way into state-level health policies, that the health of everybody suffers, including the health of white supporters. And so, in a way, what I'm making is a policy argument about how when white anxiety, a particular anxiety that minorities and immigrants are going to take away all this things that are ours, when that kind of anxiety works its way into policy, then there are dramatic effects at population-level health. And the other part is then you would think that states like Kansas and Missouri and Tennessee would be kind of points of alarm that we would say as a country, oh my gosh, life expectancy is falling in these states. Let's do everything we can to improve it. Instead, what happens with the Trump administration is that these state policies become frameworks for what we're doing at the national level in all of these three areas. So pretty scary stuff.
Things that were just state laws, but now they're looked at as a potential national policy as well.
Correct.
A phone call here from Phil in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jonathan Metzl, the author of Dying of Whiteness.
I'm enjoying your show again. I wanted to mention that it seems to me, as I ponder this business of gun deaths and Muslim being slaughtered in churches and what's happening in Missouri, whether or not you factor in our culture as regards Hollywood and the movies that are created to a young white man or white-skinned man or a black-skinned man, what's been created out of Hollywood for years of men, handsome men or brave men or bad men, holding guns, shooting war movies that make a lot of profit, that doesn't factor in to the reality of what we have today in our culture.
All right.
I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks for that, Phil. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. That's a great question. I mean, the question really is what are the causal factors that lead to people to have these kind of assumptions? I certainly have looked at a lot of movies, and I would agree with you that there is a kind of glorification of the gun in many movies. The problem with that argument at a data level is that think of all the people who watch movies or play video games or do all these factors as opposed to the number of people who actually go on to use guns or buy guns or shoot guns. And so in a way, the question is, like, of all the zillions of people who are watching movies, how does that link to actual, you know, mortality trends, right? But I will say, that there's another factor here, which is I also in the book look at advertisements for a number of weapons. And I can say that a lot of the things that I'm talking about here in terms of guns being constructed as symbols of white privilege, or there are some of the ads I show that basically talk about, the ad tagline was, restore the balance of power, that basically white men had lost power and getting a gun was a way to get it back. And so there was a lot of NRA rhetoric and gun advertisements that I thought were quite consciously playing with this history.
Yeah, like reclaim your man card, wasn't that one of the taglines?
The man card, yeah. No, I have a lot in there about the man card. So basically the idea was, you know, you, white man, you've lost your privilege, you've lost your masculinity, and the way to get that back is to buy a Bushmaster AR-15. That ad came out before the Sandy Hook shooting, and then that was the weapon that it turned out the Sandy Hook shooter used in the Sandy Hook shooting. So there was a lot of controversy about that ad. Now, again, a lot of people watch ads, and the number of people who will end up firing guns after seeing the ads is minuscule, but it is I think fair to think about what is creating the aura or the representation of this idea that to be a white man or a Republican or whatever is you need an AR-15 for that. And I certainly think that was coming from advertising, and that assumption is also at the core of a lawsuit that was just allowed to go forward about the Sandy Hook case
against was it Remington?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Here's another phone call from Eli in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jonathan Metzl.
Yeah. I heard him say that there was a white man who was needed medical care and had oxygen, and he said he would rather
die than take Obamacare, yeah.
Not have that tax on illegal aliens and welfare queens than be able to use it himself. And the author overlaid on that his own interpretation that that was due to racism and bigotry. And it seems to me that I know a lot of people who don't like their taxes going to illegal aliens or people who scam the welfare system. It has nothing to do with race. It has to do with fairness.
All right, leave time for a response here. Up to a break. Thanks for that call, Eli.
Yeah, thanks, Eli. I mean, certainly I talk to many people in my research who I think were incredibly passionate and believable proponents of small government and lower taxes, and I'm very respectful. As I mentioned before, I'm somebody who grew up in that environment myself, and so I can completely understand that. But even in your question, with respect, you know, there are assumptions about health insurance, you know, going to lazy minorities or illegal immigrants. It turns out Medicaid, for example, as a government program, doesn't support illegal immigrants, as you say, or people who are undocumented. And so, in a way, there's no Medicaid money whatsoever that's going to healthcare there. And more broadly, I guess I just believe, as a physician, that healthcare systems and healthcare networks work better when the more people are involved in the networks. You know, that's the benefit. So we could have a longer conversation about how health insurance works. But certainly, you want the most people possible in the network.
Eli, again, thanks for the comment. Jonathan Metzl, our guest, Dying of Whiteness, the book, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about America and laws that work against people's self-interest, not just their economic self-interest, but as Jonathan Metzl writes in his book, Dying of Whiteness, their lifespans, which have shortened, he can demonstrate, in Missouri, Tennessee, and Kansas. Missouri liberalized its gun laws. Tennessee didn't expand its Medicaid program. And Kansas made major cuts in taxes and services. Dying of Whiteness, the subtitle is How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. On the guns issue, which we seem to have spent a lot of time on here, we have an email from Scott in Ashland who says, I would expect that one thing informing the African-American reaction to open carry laws is that an African-American man openly carrying a firearm, even with a legal entitlement to do so, greatly increases his chances of being shot and killed in any interaction with law enforcement officers. We also have a phone call here from Bob in Roseburg. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, I have a question. I was wondering, how do you equate, you seem to kind of equate guns with white privilege, and I was wondering if how do you explain the 75% of the casualties that we've had in all of the wars and excursions we've had across the globe? About 75% of those deaths are white males.
So in the American military, you're saying?
Yes, I am. And then another thing I want to say is why...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand. The 75%, could you...
So when people die of guns in the military, it's white men, you're saying, 75% of the time?
Yeah, there's a lot of great articles about it, and it's something that doesn't get discussed. So when we talk about white privilege and, you know, whites owning guns and things like that because they're resentful of whatever, illegal aliens or whatever, but we don't talk about all those folks that... white people, white men that have died and fighting for our country. And another thing that doesn't get discussed, you mentioned about Medicaid doesn't pay for illegal aliens, but, you know, there's millions of them in our country, and somebody's paying for it.
But not Medicaid, I think was the point here. But Bob, thanks for the comments, and we can run with that. Jonathan.
Well, yeah, lots to go on, you know, combining the Bob's call and the comment also. You know, I would say that partially, let me be clear, that I'm making a historical argument about weapons. In other words, in the book, I track the history of why it is that weapons become, particular guns, become these racial symbols, and I tell the kind of 200-year story pretty quickly of why, there are laws in this country for a very long time that made it okay for white Americans to carry weapons and carry them in public, but when black Americans tried to do so, they were often attacked or rounded up, and I think that history, as I tell it in the book, really helps explain the very differing racial responses that we get to, again, who gets to carry a weapon into Walmart Walmart who gets seen as a patriot or a freedom-loving citizen, and who is seen as a threat or a terrorist or a gang member. And we see that, you know, when as the comment suggests, Black Americans try to open carry, they are often seen as threats, and people run away or attack them or they're arrested, factors like that. I don't talk so much about the military in this book. I'm really talking about policies that affect civilian-level populations. And so I would say that was probably a little bit different of a conversation than the one that I have in the book, but certainly one that I think is important. And I just want to be very clear, I'm not making an argument. I'm not trying to take away anybody's gun. I didn't go talk to people because I was trying to instill some kind of liberal ideology. Again, I grew up in gun culture, and I myself was born on a military base. My dad was in the Air Force. And so it's not like I was trying to say that I'm pro or anti-Second Amendment. Really, what I try to do in the book is understand how guns become parts of people's identities in a way, and then how those identities intersect with the histories of race that we've been talking about in this program.
And race aside, when you talk about how guns just become a part of a person's life, I was struck by the woman in a group where they were discussing people in their family who'd committed suicide by gun, but she was still very pro-gun.
I mean, again, it wasn't my job to talk people into any particular position, and I feel myself a little bit confused about that, again, because I think that there is a long history of gun ownership in this country. But I can say honestly that there isn't, I mean, for me, in the span of doing all this research, there was nothing more powerful than going down to Missouri and sitting in support groups for people who were themselves quite pro-gun, very often brought their guns to the meetings, but they had also lost children or husbands, wives, parents to gun suicide. And so I guess the question that I had was, having gone through such profound gun-related trauma, how did it make you feel about guns? And to a person, people told me it didn't change their opinion about the rights of gun ownership. That remained very important for them, but it did change their idea about kind of safety and safe practice.
So again, Missouri, the issue was guns. Tennessee, we talked about Tennessee did not go for the Medicaid expansion that Kentucky did take. We haven't talked about Kansas yet at all. Huge tax cuts, big school cuts were supposed to zoom the economy, and yet what happened there?
Kansas had a dramatic fall from grace. So Kansas, you know, even before the tax cuts, was always in the top 10 in the United States in terms of public education. The public school system in Kansas was phenomenal. There were also great infrastructure. It always got an A-plus rating because of its roads and bridges and other infrastructure factors. Then Sam Brownback takes over as governor of Kansas in this kind of libertarian drive, Tea Party drive, and basically says your money shouldn't be going to the government. It should be going back to you. It turned out what back to you meant was people at the very, very top of the income scale and corporations. They came out really well. But working class people across the board suffered dramatically. What I show in the book, for example, is that the schools in many solidly red areas ended up getting the budgets for those schools got cut dramatically. And what we see was white high school dropout rates because of the failing school support system. And so again, here were policies that claimed to bolster, you know, white America, make white America great again, but at the on the ground level, these policies were making working class white people's lives harder, sicker, and shorter.
Because lack of education leads to other outcomes that do shorten life?
Exactly right. You know, there's data that that I cite in the book that people have studied. This basically show that if you drop out of high school, if you don't graduate high school, it leads to about a 7 to 9 year shorter life expectancy. And that's because, you know, you'll have maybe a different kind of job, less health care, less access to good food, factors like that. And so it's no mystery that if you drop out of high school, you have a shorter lifespan. And so what I did in the book was basically I just counted how many people were dropping out of high school and the politics of that after these tax cuts started. And it turned out, again, that what I found was that even in the 3 or 4 years after the tax cuts started, it cost Kansas about 7,000 life years. And these are white working class life years.
And how much challenging did you do of the assumptions you were making and the connections you were making in drawing lines from cause to effect?
Right. I mean, there is no clear line, of course, between cause and effect, and I try to be very clear that it's not like A ever leads to B. So what you do is you try to kind of track demographic trends. But, you know, we have no problem. When something has a positive public health benefit, we have no problem saying, for example, I know this is really contested right now, but that, you know, vaccines lead to decreasing rates of a particular illness, or seatbelts lead to decreasing rates of fatality from a car crash. So I'm basically just using the same methodology, but turning it on its head and saying, here are some things we did that led to worse outcomes. And so using kind of standard public health methods. And I have to say that I understand that, as we say in the field, correlation does not mean causation. There were many, many other factors, some of which had to do with race, some of which had to do with everything else in the world. But I would also say that it does seem, I mean, part of what I argue in the book is that really what I think we should do moving forward is that there should be demands by working class white communities to demand better health outcomes from the policies they support. And so in a way, until that happens, we're going to continue to see these trends.
Obviously, in any political campaign, you get a lot of things said that are designed to flare people up and get them to vote on the measures. The party bus story comes up a few times in the discussion of Kansas voting for the big tax cuts. What was that about?
You know, I talked to a number of white Kansans who basically made a similar argument to what we heard about health care. They said, I'm paying all this tax money for the public school system, but all my money is going to minority districts who are spending all of that money they're getting from the state on party buses. I don't know where this party bus myth came about, but I called a lot of minority school districts and I asked them if they had party buses, and nobody had any idea what I was talking about. But it was this kind of myth that basically I'm working hard for my money and someone else is usurping that. Someone else is gaming the system. Now, again, I'm all for equity. I'm all for fairness. People work hard and they should see a benefit from tax dollars. But the irony of this particular story is that the people I felt who were usurping, in other words, the bad outcomes that were going from the misuse of tax dollars, were coming from above, right? They were coming from the people at the very top of the economic system who were, in a way, gaining tremendous benefit by massive tax cuts, not paying into the system at all. And so I kept wondering, like, why aren't people looking up? Everybody kept looking down that I spoke to, and I think it was because it played into these powerful, powerful racial stereotypes.
Let's come back to Tennessee, which again, the issue you cover there was that Tennessee chose not to expand Medicaid, which it could have done under the Affordable Care Act. Kentucky did, and they have different outcomes. The stats are there plain to see. We talked about Trevor, who was very sick and said he'd rather die than have his state take money and run with ACA. Now, Tennessee, you point out, had an innovative program called TennCare. When was that a thing, and what happened to it?
You know, Tennessee is like the health insurance capital of the world, pretty much. And, you know, right now we have HCA and other big corporations there, so there's long been an awareness of the importance of health insurance in Tennessee. In the 1990s, there was failing health and rising medical costs. And so the governor at the time basically came up with this innovative public-private partnership called TennCare. It was a program that was supposed to basically insure every citizen of Tennessee. The program started off to great fanfare in the 1990s, and Tennessee was called a kind of southern oasis of healthcare. And unfortunately, what happens is that if you haven't given people health care in a state for a very long time, there are a lot of really sick people out there. There's a lot of need. And so very quickly what happened was the demand was so great that it literally kind of crashed the system in a particular way. But there was this long drive in a state like Tennessee to say, hey, look, we're going to model for the country how government and private industry can work together to provide quality health insurance. So Tennessee was, in a way, I thought, very open to what the Affordable Care Act, before it became Obamacare, before all the political stuff. The Affordable Care Act was based on a model that was similar to what Tennessee was doing, except that it at least attempted to get the funding part right. And the irony was that 70% or upwards of the funding for the program was going to come from the federal government to, in a way, bolster health care across the state. And so, you know, if any state was going to be open to this kind of reform, it would be Tennessee. But instead, people elected politicians who ran on the platform of blocking the Medicaid expansion, and it never came to be.
We have an email here. I don't know if it's Jan or Jan, but it says, the man described as voting against his interests sounds like my father. Over many years of talking to him, he could not substantially change. His brain seemed stuck, which leads us to the point you make in the book. You're not suggesting that everyone become a Democrat, but what kinds of remedies do you suggest?
Well, I'm not at all suggesting that everybody become a Democrat. I'm not taking a side. And I mean, obviously, I'm a very open writer. I hope people feel so. I do kind of, when things seem nonsensical to me, that was partially why I wrote the book. But I think that's right. I mean, as I was saying before, I think part of a way forward here. I get asked a lot after having written the book, what will it take to have Trump voters change their minds? And I don't feel like I'm in the business, and we shouldn't be in the business of like trying to talk people out of ideologies. I think part of the issue here is that change will happen when working class white communities start to demand politics that end up at politics and policies that end up being better for them. In other words, why can't you be Republican and also want a functioning healthcare system? Why can't you be Republican and also want a better school system or better roads? It turns out when policies do those kind of things to working class people, the health of everybody is improved. So part of what I argue in the book is that we should argue for a kind of progressive conservatism where people demand more of the politicians that they're asking beyond just ideology or tweets or distractions. And in the conclusion of the book, I talk to a lot of people who are Republican who feel the same way. There are great models for people who feel like the Republican Party isn't doing enough for its base. And unfortunately, those voices get drowned out by all the other rhetoric. But I feel like there's a certain amount of promise in that if people could align around these core issues, it would actually be to the betterment of society. So partially that's what I'm arguing. And then, of course, because this is a book about whiteness, I also argue that we have to have a much more open, honest conversation about what whiteness is in this country. It just seems incredibly wrong to me that the one person who gets to define this right now is President Trump. It's a particular strain of whiteness, but we're much more generous and better than that.
Jonathan Metzl, the author of Dying of Whiteness, thank you so much for joining us today on the
My
Jefferson
pleasure.
Exchange.
Thank you. Great conversation.
Take care.